Welcome to Act and Unwind, an ongoing conversation on a free and virtuous society. I'm your host, Dan Huger. Eric Cohn is out this week. Thank you for listening. I want to ask that if you're listening to us on our website, that you navigate to our show notes for this episode to find a link to subscribe directly to Act and Unwind at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to fine podcasts. And if you like this program, please leave a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts so as to help more people find this show. This week, I'm joined by Noah Gould, alumni and student programs manager at the Acton Institute. I'm also joined by Emily Zanotti, contributing editor here at the Acton Institute. Today, we'll be talking about the announcement of the God Bless the USA Bible, the only Bible endorsed by President Trump and country music sensation Lee Greenwood. What does this reveal about the state of religion, politics, and culture in America today? Then we'll spring into a broader conversation about classic models of culture war, strange new movements on that theme, and potential constructive alternatives to addressing culture and life in the nation and in the world. But first, I want to begin our discussion by turning our attention to Baltimore, where late last week, the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed after the container ship Dolly struck one of its piers. Two people were rescued from the river. Six members of the construction crew working on the roadway were reported missing. Two bodies have been recovered, and the other four are now presumed dead. Video footage of this collapse is terrifying, and Baltimore's Mayor Brandon Scott told reporters it looks like something out of an action movie. The Economist reports, quote, the 300-meter-long ship, the Dali, was heading from Baltimore to Colombo in Sri Lanka when it lost propulsion, according to an unclassified cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency report. The crew reportedly notified officials that the bridge collision was likely. Eyewitnesses say the ship's lights flickered just before impact. Locals heard a loud thunder-like rumble in the middle of the night. The house started shaking, says Cyrus Gilbert, a resident of Locust Point, directly across the harbor. End quote. Investigations are unfolding and discussion of reconstruction has already begun. Again, from The Economist, President Biden promises to foot the bill to get the bridge rebuilt as soon as possible. But the impact on the city is already being felt. The port is closed until further notice, causing ripples beyond the harbor. The port supports over 15,000 direct jobs, and roughly 140,000 jobs are linked to it in some way. This is a major, major American port. The harbor is an important link in America's supply chain. More than 50 ocean carriers make nearly 1,800 annual visits. It is especially important in the automotive world. Its private and public terminals handled nearly 850,000 cars and light trucks in 2023, the most of any American port. It also ranked first in the country in handling farm and construction machinery, as well as imported sugar and gypsum, and ranks second for coal exports, end quote. This will be a massive and massively expensive undertaking to rebuild this. Gene Eaglesham, reporting for the Wall Street Journal, explores many of the potential paths to litigation over liability, saying, quote, the fight, maritime lawyers say, could run as long as a decade. It will be one of the most contentious marine insurance cases in recent decades, said Brennan, a law professor and retired captain in the U.S. Navy. While the lawyers fight, most of the claims will likely get paid out by insurers, including money for the bridge's reconstruction. Then they will duke it out among themselves. Other claims might take longer, including those by families of people killed in the crash. Unquote. We'll link both pieces to the show notes. There's a lot of dimensions to this. There is a moral dimension. There's an economic dimension, and there's a political dimension here. And I guess this story really caught fire because of the dramatic video footage that was sort of shared everywhere that day. And it's truly terrifying. You see, you know, you see the laws of physics in their most horrific aspect as this ship just tears through this bridge. And I couldn't help but wondering, and this is early before we knew about exactly how many people were killed, exactly how many survivors. I always wonder with these sorts of things, when the mayor of Baltimore is describing it as being like an action movie, he's right. But it also, there's a way in which that trivializes what happens as well. What was your like immediate sort of visceral reaction to the footage? And did you feel, I felt I stopped at a certain point. Like I got to a certain point where the ship hit the bridge, and then I was like, I just cannot watch this anymore. This seems
to have kind of like Edmund Fitzgerald vibes. Like you're watching something happen in real time that's actually killing people. That's now sort of been turned into a cultural incident because it was everywhere almost as soon as it happened. It was crazy. I must have watched the video over and over and over again. Probably sped up, slowed down. It took a while to realize that there is a version of the video that's actually sped up. So you can see the ship hitting the bridge and the bridge collapsing all within the span of about a minute and a half, whereas it took a little bit longer than that. But what I found really interesting is then later on, when you see the video, you assume all sorts of damage and death. And then they came back and said, no, actually, the ship told us they were losing power and that they were likely going to crash the bridge. And they pulled off almost everybody except for a number of workers. So the number of lives that were actually saved isn't reflected in the video, which I think when we have this sort of cultural sadness that happens, we don't get the full picture of the story. But the other thing that I also heard immediately was that everyone's packages from Amazon were going to take 6 weeks now instead of overnight, because that's actually the only route across that for delivery trucks. So not only is it killing shipping, is it actually killing overland deliveries, because there's no real good way to go over that body of water without taking yourself an hour to 2 hours out of your way. So it's really interesting how that impact was felt immediately. Like everybody's Amazons just were like, oh, well, no, not anymore. We'll see you when we see you, kind of thing. So our lives are so impacted by something that seems so remote and social media-y and entertainment focused, and yet it has an immediate effect on your life and my life. Gypsum is drywall, right?
Yeah.
So if you want to build a house, you're going to feel that right.
I think one of the reasons why it was so visceral is it's one of these things that we all kind of take for granted, and we go over bridges all the time. I watched it, and then for the next few days, I was just aware every time I went over a bridge in a way that I am not usually.
Yeah.
So that's, and I think we all kind of interpreted the event as it was happening before we knew, like Emily said, some of these really crucial parts of the narrative. Like, yes, the bridge or the boat did warn the bridge ahead of time to try to block it off. And so we kind of interpreted all the data that was coming at us instead of being told a narrative ahead of, you know, this is the narrative of what happened, and interpret it that way and then challenge that narrative and go forward. No, instead it was us just taking data points and just kind of those were pinging off of us and we were all interpreting it as it came in. So this is a very interesting way in which we all interpret events like this in a different way. As we kind of now are aware of some of these things that are hidden, I was impressed by just the complexity of the world around us and everything that went over and under that bridge. Like there's huge amount of global trade that I think it was $80 billion of trade last year, a huge amount of trade. And then like over 10 million people who cross over that bridge, including all the different deliveries. And so it's so much complexity of all these things that we just don't even think about in our infrastructure.
Yeah, there's at least one person I know who has their car has been delayed by this. This is, again, like The Economist reporting, there's a tremendous amount of all sorts of goods that go in and out of these ports. The last time we had a disruption like this is we had a very severe hurricane in Florida that affected some of the larger ports down there. And they'll continue to be this economic destruction. But when you talk about narratives, Noah, and this was the other interesting thing watching this unfold online. And we talked a little bit about, you know, there is going to be an inquiry into who's at blame and who's at fault. And that is going to take years. And the justice system will move very slowly on this. There are a lot of people, you know, this is going to be an immensely difficult thing to fix. This is going to take a tremendous amount of energy, a tremendous amount of money and resources to, you know, getting the port back up to where it's a working port. But in the aftermath on social media, as everybody's watching this, they do what we don't want people to do in cases like this, which is to speculate. And as to the causes of this, there were numerous people that were saying, you know, blaming, DEI, of all things, for this sort of thing, and people trying to shoehorn whatever it was, their political pet cause, into all of a sudden, you know, this becomes the villain of this particular disaster. Did either of you see any of that? And what do you think of this sort of weaponization of disasters for political ends?
It's bizarre to me because happens kind of only on Twitter. You see the people who are most likely to do this are also the loudest voices sometimes. I saw electromagnetic pulse. I saw hacking as blamed for it within a few minutes. But it was almost like the night before the Kate Middleton thing had come to an end. So they spent 2 or 3 weeks speculating on, was Kate Middleton dead? Is she a robot? Are they using lookalikes? And Occam's razor said she was sick and was going to continue to be out of the public eye until Easter. And Occam's razor was correct. And in this instance, Occam's razor suggested that the ship lost power and something went technically wrong that was not connected to anything else. And the ship hit the bridge and the bridge collapsed. And Occam's razor was correct. but Occam's razor is never enough for the human mind, right? And this is in the wake of any sort of tragedy, whether it's a school shooting or a bridge collapse. We want to feel like we have a purpose in fixing what just happened. So if we are more, you know, if we're more vocal about how the COVID vaccine gave somebody on the ship a heart attack and they drove the drove it into a pylon of the bridge and this collapsed, and obviously COVID is now to blame for the bridge collapse. We want to see that in our brain because we know we were previously opposed to some part of that, or an EMP, or hacking, or artificial intelligence, or Kate Middleton. Like, somebody was to blame, and that thing we can do is address it and fix it. But these problems have more complex reasons, more complex scenarios, or less complex in this case. So in this case of a school shooting, we always come out and say, we want to put SRO officers, we want to ban guns, and really, I don't know how you could prevent it. And in this case, we're like, we should outlaw EMPs and check everybody who's had the COVID vaccine who drives a ship and make sure that they aren't part of this DEI program for ship drivers. We want to believe that we have the power to do something about things that don't necessarily have a perfect explanation. And I think that's just part of the human condition.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things, you know, I was surprised as I was talking to some people as this was unfolding and people were trying to process this, is people didn't really have a handle on just how heavy these ships are and how loaded up they are and what and just the amount of momentum at any given time that these ships, even when they lose power, that they still, this object will remain in motion until there is the sort of countervailing force to block it, and it will shred through everything until it gets to that point. Noah, did you see similar sort of reactions from folks?
Yeah, they're kind of inescapable, and I think Ebley's wise to point out that the Kate Middleton thing had just wrapped up. It's almost like we're given this thing that's just too tempting to not comment your wild conspiracy on, and then we all have to obsess about it for 2.3 days and then move on to the next thing. And the incentives are all there for people to be the first ones to comment and give the first take on whatever disaster, with generally very little compassion on what's happening. You know, and Emily, you missed the chance to say, oh, Lincoln show notes to my conspiracy on this. But this is kind of the self-promotion and first take. I think that the kind of diversity hire, you saw that with a mayor who's elected by 70 plus percent of votes. That was particularly offensive. But there's a whole bunch of takes that everyone's going to, here is my one thing that brings together all the harms in the universe, and if we solve this one thing, you know, ships wouldn't crash into bridges. I don't know. There's a certain amount of risk in any kind of infrastructure, and it's hard to just accept that. Oh yeah, there's a certain amount of these things happen.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about the economic dimensions of this. We've talked a little bit about the sort of moral dimensions of this. But there's also political dimensions to this. This is, you know, something where, you know, President Biden, you know, came to the fore and said, you know, we're going to take care of this. We're going to fix this. But it's like, you know, all of this is insured. And it's the wonderful Wall Street Journal, you know, despite how many years it might be to process and adjudicate who is finally financially liable for this, those checks are going to be written by the insurance companies before that that pans itself out. Now, there could be a role for government, certainly in search and rescue operations for those folks that are still missing. But this idea that, you know, it's both our pet conspiracies and our pet notions of sort of like, okay, like, you know, in Joe Biden's case, that the federal government is going to fix this. And it's like, no, there's a whole economic structure in place because people know that disasters like this can and will happen. And people factor this in, people insure for these sorts of things. And those funds will be available from those sources as well. Do you see anybody else sort of trying to politically capitalize in this in a way that seemed unwarranted?
I mean, the best types of promises are promises that make everyone feel kind of warm and fuzzy and that you don't have to deliver on. It's a great deal for anyone right now who's just promising, hey, I'll fix it. I'll put up the money. Yeah, I think we see this all over the place. This is – maybe I've talked about this on here before, but I call this the NPR answer. I'll be listening to NPR on the way to work. And they'll have some interesting story about some problem, you know, in the country, and I'll be on board. Oh yeah, this is really interesting. They're doing some reporting here, and then like clockwork, they get to the end of the segment, and they'll say, "And so the federal government needs to be doing more about this." It's like, oh, I was actually kind of tracking with you until we got to the end of this segment because there's a bunch of actors who could do something, and yeah, sure, the federal government could do something. Maybe. Are they the best person? Is it government? Even if I grant that it is government, do something, what's the best level? I mean, this is just kind of a given that we go to the highest, the largest budget body available to us at any time.
Yeah, well, and also, I mean, when you look at a place like Florida, that was hit by the hurricane and washed out a bridge just, you know, within the year. Florida got to it quickly, got the bridge rebuilt, got some functional transportation out to Sanibel Island. And that's because state government and local government are better positioned for those things. They know what the residents need. They have the funds in place for this kind of thing. They know the type of infrastructure that's required. They have contractors on speed dial. Those people are affiliated with both local and state governments. And we talk a lot about subsidiarity. But this is really where it comes into play, because your local government, your state government are going to be quicker, they're going to be more efficient, and they're going to be more effective. And that's not to say that there's, you know, this high bar, but the federal government is going to lumber its way across six states and then throw a bunch of money at you and not quite figure out what you're supposed to do with it, but you have a lot of paperwork to do. FEMA is a good example. So just here in Nashville, we had some tornadoes that happened over just before Christmas. And state government was on scene right away. Nashville Metropolitan Government was on scene right away. Chick-fil-A was on the scene right away. FEMA showed up 2 weeks later. And so, like, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to wait 2 weeks for the federal government to lumber its way from Washington, D.C. to Nashville, Tennessee to give you money and get your power going back on? No. That is the job of the local, the smallest local entity. And that's where it works. So to always constantly rely on this federal government seems not just silly, but like completely inefficient when it comes to restoring order on this kind of level.
So this is interesting. When you mentioned this subsidiarity, we had very bad storms a couple months back, terrible sort of like tornado-esque velocity winds, although I think there was a tornado north of the city, but nothing within the city limits itself. But I live next to a plot of land owned by the West Michigan Land Conservancy, and all these trees got down, and they're going to do a controlled burn in the conservancy now because there's so much down trees and the rest of it. And they sent me a notice in the mail, and all of a sudden, you know, I go on their website and there's like a place to sign up for volunteers. And I'm like, you know what? This is literally just outside my door. This would be a lot of fun to get to know people in the neighborhood and address this local problem. And maybe that's the takeaway from these sorts of things is that, you know, we're not just powerless before our screens watching the boats slowly crash into the bridge. It's like, you know, we all live in these communities that are affected by these various things, and we can make a difference and, you know, do something beyond speculate and bring some healing and some revival to our own communities. Now, we have an interesting topic next. This is kind of a big transition from a national disaster to a bit of religious entrepreneurship. Last week on Holy Tuesday, President Trump announced on Truth Social the publication of the God Bless the USA Bible. The Bible is described as follows on its website, quote, "Easy to read, large print, and slim design. This Bible invites you to explore God's Word anywhere, anytime. This Bible has been designed so that it delivers an easy reading experience in the trusted King James Version translation. This large print Bible will be perfect to take to church, a Bible study, work, travel, etc. The Bible also features a copy of Handwritten Chorus to God Bless the USA by Lynn Greenwood, U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, the Pledge of Allegiance," end quote. The site also notes that this is the only Bible endorsed by President Trump and Lee Greenwood separately, not together. They also do not endorse a single Bible apart from this Bible. And President Trump in his pitch proclaimed, quote, "Happy Holy Week. Let's make America pray again. As we lead into Good Friday and Easter, I encourage you to get a copy of the God Bless the USA Bible," end quote. This was another one of these sort of online events when it happened that sort of everybody had a reaction to. And Emily, I can see part of your reaction now. This is a week later. We are now past Easter. We hope that all of you had a blessed Easter and a wonderful end to your Holy Week. But into this next week, Emily is still struggling to come to terms to this. I can see. Emily, what are your thoughts?
Even now, I think this is why Jesus was flipping the tables at the temple, right? It's like, this is exactly the same thing. Like, please don't bring this in. I think in this country, we're seeing this bizarre mashup between Christianity and, well, religion in general and the religion of Trumpism. At some point, it's just going to all mesh together and you might have Trump, you get like Trump churches that have like 40,000 people that show up every week. I'm glad I'm Catholic because I don't use this translation of the Bible, so I don't have to worry about whether my Bible is Trump approved or not when I carry with me, I guess. I don't know. I don't know. Yep. Just flipping tables in the temple. That's all I feel like.
So I am Catholic, and I do use this translation of the Bible, the King James translation, which I commend to readers. Maybe not this particular edition. There are many. This is a publicly domain available translation. All of you can download it to your phones on your phones. You can all look at it online till your heart's content. It's freely and widely available. Why this product then? Noah, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's just a signal of, on one side, that, you know, Donald Trump would endorse this Bible, that kind of signals to the people who are Christians who are voting for him. What's interesting to me is, if you listen to the language, if we're going to use it very literally, this is the only Bible endorsed by Donald Trump, which I guess would imply that he doesn't endorse any other Bibles. So he doesn't quite – we got to be careful not – we might get in trouble with Donald if we read any other Bibles, like, I guess. But it's a very interesting – if you think about from the business angle, I was looking at the FAQs on the website, and it says, does any of this money go to the presidential campaign for Donald Trump? And it says, absolutely not. This is not a political book in any way. This Donald Trump's name, image, and likeness is used under license. So he's just getting – it's not even needing to funnel through his campaign. He's getting this money directly. And others have pointed out, why use the King James in public domain so you don't have to pay a translator? So – and $60 for a Bible is quite a lot of money. So this is a quite lucrative product. I think it's to
say, this is a collector's item.
Yeah.
I mean, like the Trumpy Bear from the last election cycle. I feel like if you're like me and you kind of collect sort of weird political ephemera, like I have, you know, Joe Biden koozies and various campaign posters. But like, I guess in a sense, it's like trying to make it a collector's item, like those Franklin Mint plates my mom used to hang on the wall when I was a kid, like as a generation of boomers now. Like putting up their Trump collection with like their Trump, like, is there like an eagle painting where the eagle's crying and Trump is here? Like, I feel like there's so much irony in this, but like they're not being ironic at all. Like, I want to pick it up at a Goodwill and put it on my in my collection, but I'm not going to pay $75 for a Trump Bible, because for me it's sad that it's even come to this. Like, it's kind of sad that we're selling Bibles with Lee Greenwood. And what does the Bible really have to do with the founding of America, in the sense that the founders were really deists and not really King James Bible people, and in some cases we're Catholics and we're across the board. I mean it's kind of trying to shoehorn this vision of make America great again into make Christianity great again. In a sense that, like, even if he loses the presidential election, he's got his next job lined up for himself after this. But it's just very weird. It's like profoundly weird.
Yeah, there's a long tradition, if you think about, of American politicians trying to remake the Bible in their own image. If you think back to the Thomas Jefferson Bible, he didn't add things. He just took all the things out that he didn't like. So this is in a line of kind of trying to shoehorn the Bible into your preferred image of the world. And it may speak to the fact that maybe you've seen some of the data on kind of the term evangelical and how maybe it is more descriptive politically than theologically. There's more that ties that group together as far as their political beliefs instead of a set of statements that they could assent to theologically. So this ties into that theme as well.
So first I rose.
There's also, I was gonna piggybacking on what Noah said. I think there's also an overarching theme that you see sort of with Trumpism overall. And that is, like, there's a growing number of Christians and evangelical Christians in this country who identify as Christians but are not church-going Christians. There's sort of a cultural Christianity or a cultural American Christianity that's developed sort of over the last 25 years, maybe started with the Moral Majority and James Dobson and a lot of things that happened in the 90s. There's sort of this cultural Christianity that's developed parallel to Christianity. And this seems like the fruit of that in some cases. Like, you are a Bible-believing Christian, but this also seems like a good idea to you. I think that there is a certain level of cultural Christianity where you would just be like, yeah, this makes total sense to me because everything that I've consumed in the last 30 years has now been packaged and interpreted for me by celebrity preachers and celebrity pastors and Joel Osteen and Rick Warren. And is it really that different from some of these products that have been mass marketed? I don't know. I think that there's something there to explore, though.
So I think there's an older American legacy of this. And Noah hinted at this with the Jefferson Bible. We also have one of the founders of sort of the world's largest, and certainly one of its nation's largest, new religious movements, Joseph Smith, who was the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who ran for president early on, and who also, did a translation of the Bible. He also... And the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints continues to believe this, that the American founding documents are in some way divinely inspired. And this is an official position of the church. But I think, so that's a very narrow but extreme example of this. But then there's a broader example, and I couldn't help when I saw this Bible to remember a number of years ago, the American Bible Society came out with a Bible called the Faith and Liberty Bible, which I looked up before the show the ad copy for this. This was in the Good News Translation, which is the American Bible Society's major translation. It says, the Faith and Liberty Bible offers 813 articles and quotations from people in American history who have drawn on the Bible in their work and writings. Each piece is annotated and reviewed by a team of scholars of American history, law, and religion, and placed near the biblical passage it quotes, end quote. The editor of this was Alan Crippen, who I interviewed actually on Acton Line years ago when he was here on William Penn. And like, it was a great interview. There are great historians involved in this Bible: Daniel Dreisbach, Mark David Hall, Thomas S. Kidd, Wilfred McClay. I think this sort of project that the American Bible Society, connecting sort of, okay, how did the Bible form seminal figures in American history, and there is a way in which the Bible really, really does loom large in American life. And this sort of like civic religion, there's certain manifestations of it that ebb and they flow, but they're kind of like a persistent theme in American life rather than, I think, a modern innovation. But there is, I think there's also this, you know, usually you see with the rise of that, you see a rise in church attendance. And that ebbs and flows with those things throughout American history. And I think Emily's very right that we're not seeing that. What we're seeing in this latest manifestation is a really sort of identity-based claim to Christianity. And I want to turn now, and part of this is just to broaden out this conversation, because Noah, you wrote a fabulous piece, fabulous review of a new book by Jay Richards and James Robinson called Fight the Good Fight, How an Alliance of Faith and Reason Can Win the Culture Wars. The title of the piece was The New Culture Warriors, and we'll include it in the show notes to this. It's a very thoughtful review, and we'll also put a link to the book in this, but I don't want to so much discuss the book, which I have not read, and I don't think Emily has read. But Noah, you break down sort of, when we think about these sort of like religiously charged, politically charged issues that overlap, we often talk about this in terms of the culture war. And there is this history going back to, as Emily was saying, the moral majority and these sorts of things. And you give a sort of genealogy of that, and then point to some ways that has been less than successful and some alternative visions of that. Because I guess first, could you frame us what this classic sort of culture war is? Because it strikes me as very different from this sort of cultural Christianity that we're talking about earlier. Like, not that either approach is beyond criticism, but they seem very different.
Yeah, well, thanks, Dan. So basically what I outline in the piece is when we think about the moral majority, some of these early attempts to kind of quote, you know, turn back the tide on rising secularism and changes in different kind of mores that people like Jerry Falwell were worried about. So they have a huge kind of presence in televangelism. They're kind of fighting against what they see as kind of moral rot and trying to turn against that. And so there we see a stark, this kind of overarching.
Give us a couple for instances of what these issues were.
Yeah, so these would be things like marriage, things like feminism would be something they're worried about, things that are changing in especially the sexual revolution, the way that's changing people's opinions about kind of family life and sexuality. And then they're kind of saying, we need to fight against this. So the operating metaphor for their kind of reaction is a culture war. So they're going to fight against this. And so one of the things I think we need to grapple with more is that project pretty much failed. Abortion is another big thing that they're trying to fight against. We see kind of positions on that shift pretty dramatically, positions on marriage shift dramatically. These aren't issues that they have quote unquote won, if by winning we mean getting popular support and a legal apparatus to support, you know, their view of things. And a lot of what failed wasn't necessarily kind of being taken down by liberals. It was their kids often did not kind of follow the same path, and we saw a large amount of people leaving the church. And so that's where a lot of this shift happened. So when we kind of revive this as a generative metaphor for our whole interaction of how Christians should interact with the world, and we haven't really grappled with why the first culture wars failed, we run into a problem.
It's interesting too, because Catholicism is grappling with this right now, right? So I think evangelical Christianity grappled with this a lot in the 90s. And that led to, in the 2020s, we see with deconstruction. And Catholicism is trying to do a lot right now, or some sort of more traditionalist Catholics are kind of trying to do more of what the moral majority did in instilling purity culture and fighting feminism and things like that within the church. And do we learn those lessons? Do we say, okay, so this culture war failed. Now, how do we proceed with sort of this traditionalist movement in a way that it makes inroads into the culture? And I don't know that it's doing that. I think it's sort of following the same path that the moral majority did. But it was even a cynical ploy at the time. So if you go back to the Defense of Marriage Acts that were on ballot the second Bush term, a lot of those Defense of Marriage Acts were legitimate. And then a lot of those Defense of Marriage Acts were put on the ballot that year so that evangelical Christians who were going to vote for defending marriage in their states would also vote for George W. Bush in that second term. So it was a little bit cynical in that way too. And those children of the people who pushed that stuff then grew up and said, well, you know what? I don't know if it's government's business. It goes back to thinking about how government is a role in a life. And maybe it's a liberal position or a conservative position, but maybe government doesn't belong in the marriage business. Maybe it's not government's job to tell you that you have to look a certain way or a family has to look a certain way. If you're a Catholic and you get married in the Catholic Church, obviously a family looks a certain way. But if you're just going down to City Hall to get a piece of paper, then that's very different. So you start to see people who grow up and question it and then change it and split off from it. So there is a very good argument to be made that we need to go back and look at why the culture war failed and why these things still exist today, despite the push in the 90s. Yeah, you can have it. And then try to learn those lessons a little bit when we talk about traditionalism and Catholicism and Orthodox worship and other faiths that are kind of coming to that purity culture fork in the road now.
Yeah, I think it's appropriate, Emily, that you have some kids in the background here and we're talking about family. This is great. I'd be curious how you think about like your family and that kind of project. Is there a way that you are kind of consciously thinking, okay, this is different than someone thinking about this 50 years ago? I'd love to hear more from you on that.
Yeah, that's a big parenting project, right? Because I'm parenting in two worlds at once. I am a more traditionalist conservative Catholic, and I'm also parenting in a world where my kids are going to be inundated with more secular cultural values from the moment they wake up in the morning. You know, we live in a city. We have kids that they play with at the playground who have non-binary parents. We're constantly going to run into the idea of, why does this family look different than ours? Why does this person have two mommies? So you have to think about your cultural encounters in line with your Catholic faith, but not in such a way that you teach your children to automatically dismiss people, but also to, you know, also to grow up and continue to cling to the precepts of their faith. Because growing up in Catholic school in the 90s, it was kind of wishy-washy, and I didn't really have much experience thinking that my Catholic school was any different from any public school. And so we specifically selected a Catholic school that is very different from a public school.
This one is the space one.
Yeah. So sorry, the space episode of a cartoon is on. He doesn't like that. So we're teaching them to try to make decisions and be citizens of the world too.
Yeah, that's an interesting one of the things that you draw out there, and this is maybe a tension that is in that moral majority, is that at the same time as it was, we need to fight, we need to be really kind of aggressively against certain ideas and culture, the actual counterculture that they were offering was often very light. And so that's something that I think, I mean, I have a 1.5-year-old and another one on the way, so I'm kind of on the very beginning of this project or whatever you want to call it. But I am hyper aware of, yes, I want to be offering my kids really something of substance. And so that's, I go back to catechisms, I go back to like historically rooted faith, but I don't want to just offer them a kind of version of culture that's just, oh, the same thing as secular culture, but just with all the bad stuff removed, kind of the if you're familiar with Angel Vid's version of culture, where we'll just take out the violence and sexual content, and that's fine, but doesn't have any actual content. So that's one thing that I think parents now will be hyper aware of.
Yeah, that in the world or of the world, but not in the world, or in the world, but not of the world, that becomes really central to parenting, I think, especially when kids are really young and formative. Because when you're talking about how you're parenting your kids, you're immersing themselves in a culture and they need to know how to react to that culture. And the great part about Catholicism, and I think more deeply rooted religion and the writings, if you go further back into Protestantism, there's a lot of great theology that you can talk to your kids about, that you can distill down to the very basics and try to help them encounter the world in a way that is Catholic or a way that is Christian without immediately feeling like once they get submerged into this world, they're not going to be prepared. And for me, growing up in the 90s with a lot of that stuff, I think especially knowing girls that grew up in sort of moral majority homes and had purity balls and true love waits and how I kissed dating goodbye, those are all great examples of how the moral majority kind of approached marriage and family making in that era and how it backfired on them. And so now when we talk about how we approach it as a Catholic family or a religious family in this era, we're like, we want to be prepared. We want you to be prepared to encounter these things in your life. And then also be able to make that right decision. And whether that means like we buy a little cute mass kit and we take you to mass every week, and yeah, you're going to be good some weeks and you're not going to be good, but we're still going to go. We're going to pray before meals. We're going to talk about Jesus every single day, and immerse you in your faith in a way that makes sense and kind of seamlessly integrates into their lives. I'm hoping that that gets them a little further than it got me. Or I just hope, you know, maybe they can afford the therapy one day. I don't know, but it's a really hard place to be, right?
So one of the things that I think about whenever people have conversations about culture is like a very, very abstract word for what people believe and what people do, like literally at the most basic level, like how
how you make your bed is a cultural product. How you, you know, how you prepare a meal. Do you plate people versus does everybody come up and is every family meal like a buffet style meal? Like that is a cultural difference. And when you think about that's not the level on which a lot of this culture war rhetoric takes place. And I think the most sterling example of that rhetoric was the 1992 Republican National Convention speech with Pat Buchanan. And his metaphor was to take the metaphor of what was then very fresh memory of the LA riots and to say that like the LAPD took back Los Angeles block by block by block. We need to take America back block by block by block. Now, some people will argue that that was ineffective. Some people will argue we never really tried it. You know, Pat Buchanan was not the Republican nominee for president then or ever. While I think these critiques of things like purity culture are legitimate, there's also the reality that the religious communities that we associate most with the quote-unquote failed culture war are also those religious communities where there is the strongest belief in God, regular prayer, all of these things that we all want. Now, it could be that it's in spite of those things that those values are endured, or is a certain level of tension with the broader culture necessary to have a counterculture? Because one of the other things that, Noah, in your piece, you open up a couple of different alternatives that have been presented by various people, because it seems like I would say the result of the culture wars is mixed. I think it polarized the public in some negative ways, but it seems to have actually borne some fruit in those communities that engaged in it most persistently.
What would you see as some of that fruit?
Like belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Like if you look at – now here's the question, because there are a lot of evangelical intellectuals that are horrified that like 80% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. There are all sorts of evangelicals that are sort of scandalized by this. At the same time – if you look at belief in God, regular prayer, if you look at these like very basic things, attendance at church, like evangelicals are doing that. Mormons are doing that. Jehovah's Witnesses are doing that in ways that mainline Protestants, historically black churches, and Catholics aren't. Again, it could be something else delivering that secret sauce, but I think that's something we have to take seriously. And, you know, there are other models that could be more fruitful, but it seems like that tension with culture is something that has paid some sort of dividends or potentially paid some dividends.
There is the tension here between the medium and the message. So the medium may not have been correct, but the message may have done wonders. And I think when you're looking at people growing up today, my generation and later, a lot of people are seeking something bigger than them that was taken away from them in the 80s and 90s. And there was, in a little bit, you can play with the bubble guts. I think that there is sort of a tension between how we were given it and what it was. And when you look at the rise of the traditional church or the TLM mass and Catholicism, I think what you see are a lot of young people, a lot of young families, a lot of millennial age and younger. And why is that? Well, it's possible that people are looking for something that's giving a different message from the culture. No matter what that message is, there's something that's standing aside that culture and saying, look, this isn't great. There's a better way. And that is ultimately, I think, what we need is we talk about the tension of parenting, but the same tension exists in how we evangelize, right? So there's all of these sacred things in Catholicism. There's all these dogmatic beliefs, and those beliefs don't change and they won't change. And younger priests and younger families are embracing the churches that are more likely to say, we are different from the world. We stand apart from the world. We tell you a message that's different from what you see on the TV every single day. And when we encounter something in the world, we approach it with faith and reason. And I think that that message is really resonating with people who grew up in an era of black and white. Like either you were part of the culture secularly or you were part of the church culture and there was no in between. Now there's something that's training you to go out into the world and be different. And that appeals to a lot of people. And I think it would appeal to people across the board.
Yeah, I need to dig more into the data, Dan, that you're mentioning. But one thing that strikes me is, if we're looking at this idea of a culture war, then it does beg the question of what does winning mean? And so there may have been certain people who were defining winning as just getting people to be more faithful Christians. And in that sense, I think the war metaphor starts to break down. And then there you are going to have genuine kind of practice and people who are engaged. But then there's another, I think, strain that is more explicitly winning as in wanting Christianity to be respected by mainstream culture. And when people often talk about revival, I actually think that's often what they mean now when they say, I want revival. They just mean I want to be respected by general culture for my Christianity. They don't mean like I want more people to find faith and have practice. So in that case, it's not just, I think, the genuine tension with culture is something that Christianity is going to have, and that's just a reality. But then it's those people who see that tension in culture and then want to kind of erase the tension or the culture war as overcoming the other side, so there's not that tension. So that's some of that the nuance between those two groups potentially.
Okay. No, that's helpful. No, I mean, this data, I'll put in, I was actually looking, Pew Religious Landscape Survey does a really, really good job of these general trends. The last one was in 2014, though. There was a 2007, there was a 2014, and I think COVID might have disrupted what was going to be their next cycle. But, yeah, I mean, but this is one of those things is you do see stark differences. Roman Catholics tend to look like Americans, generally. Like this is something that, you know, if you I've talked to people in political science fields that they're like, there's no such thing as the Catholic vote because Catholics are basically just like median voters. Like, you know, we have President Biden and we have Justice Thomas and we have folks all along, it's a here comes everybody kind of religion. And you get the only, and there's a way in which evangelical Christianity is really unique in a way that, you know, some of these, they seem to have gotten some level of resistance to the broader culture. Some of that might be pathological and misguided, but some of that has also caused this to be a religious movement in the United States that's not in decline. It's just about as long as they've been tracking it, about a quarter of Americans have been evangelicals. And just about everybody else they've been tracking has been getting smaller, Mormons excluded. But you've got—
Catholicism is also interesting in the sense that it's a culture as well as a religion. So growing up, I didn't go to church weekly, but my parents had a picture of John the 23rd and Frank Sinatra and John F. Kennedy in their front room because they were all big-time Catholics. Did any of them act like Catholics? Maybe John the 23rd. But like, ultimately, it was a cultural thing, not necessarily a religious thing. And I think you see that coming to a head with people like Joe Biden, who were raised Catholic in the sense that they were raised Irish or they were raised Italian. And Catholicism was just a part of daily life. And then you still went to the ballot box and voted however you felt you wanted to. And so people like Joe Biden maybe are coming to terms with the idea that the church is opposed to abortion and the church is opposed to assisted suicide and the church may have a problem with Transgender Awareness Day. But they don't. And they don't understand why they don't, because they've been raised kind of in this Catholic culture where everyone just voted how they wanted, regardless of what the church says, because they were Irish or Italian or a certain grade of Polish. Like, you just kind of got it from the gestalt instead of your church.
Yeah, the home altar is like the Sinatra Pope John the 23rd home altar is really the locus of a certain kind of Catholicism. This is a fascinating conversation. No, Noah, when we talk about this, so Emily gave us a vision of culture that is a religious culture that is very much apart from the culture war sort of dichotomies drawn, that's maybe interesting, quirky, maybe neutral. If it's I don't want Sinatra mandated in Catholic homes, but like I kind of like it. Like I kind of like having Dino and Frank up there. Is there a similar, when we talk about evangelicals, oftentimes, particularly in the media, people pathologize and hyper focus on the political. Is there a Frank Sinatra, John the 23rd sort of evangelical cultural thing that you can leave with our audience to show that there's more to it, that it's a stranger and more wondrous thing than they could have ever imagined?
I think the big difference, if you think about evangelical culture versus Catholic culture, is you have one guy. As in the Pope.
I thought you were speaking of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
I thought you were speaking about Dale Earnhardt.
So there isn't, evangelical isn't one thing. There isn't a central kind of organization to bring this is evangelical. It's a broad religious movement. And so I think what we're seeing is part of that movement right now as being we see the kind of political, cultural movement now, maybe in a different way that we would have at a different point in the movement. So it's just kind of where the arc of it has taken it. So that's one thing, is there isn't kind of a centralized, this is evangelical. So everyone has their kind of favorite pastor that they listen to a podcast of. There's different kind of people who would call themselves evangelical or wouldn't. It's kind of a much more mushy idea. When we think about culturally.
Or perhaps Trump, going back to the genesis of this conversation, Trump is trying to be that Robert F. Kennedy that everyone has put on their walls. You know, Catholicism or Catholics growing up in the 50s and 60s, that was kind of their Trump. He was sort of charismatic. He identified as Catholic, even though he really wasn't that Catholic to begin with. he was just a caricature and a force. And so Catholics flocked to him because he represented them, whether he was a good representative or not. So maybe that's kind of what Trump is trying to be here is, you know, maybe I will not be president forever, but I kind of would like to integrate myself into that culture and say, I'm going to be the picture that you hang on your wall and tell your kids about that time you went to a Trump rally because he represented or fought for who we were
exactly.
In the public arena.
The fought for, I think, part is really important. He said things like, I will protect Christianity, which is subtly different from saying, I am a Christian, right? He's very strongly signaling, I want to be the forefront of this and I will protect you. So that's the appeal.
So this has been a fascinating conversation, and I love this turn. So there's a little Acton history anecdote. Most of Acton's library was donated by a man named Lester DeCoster. And Lester DeCoster was longtime editor of the Christian Reformed Church's denominational magazine, The Banner, was for many years a professor at Calvin College, now Calvin University, and was for many years the head of that university's library, the Heckman Library. He was also a contributor to a publication called the Reformed Journal, which was kind of very influential in the Christian Reformed Church in West Michigan. He was also a Democrat, and in the Reformed Journal made an argument in 1960 for voting for John F. Kennedy, which was scandalous in an overwhelmingly Dutch Protestant community. And he was, Kennedy was, and this is part of why Kennedy had his resonance with Catholic communities, is because they were non-Catholic communities that very much objected to him on the basis of his Catholicism. And I think that there are a lot of people that are drawn to President Trump for the same reasons. They see themselves and people like them devalued and dismissed by the larger society. And it is a sort of almost by default sort of defensiveness. But this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for both of you and your great contributions to this. Let's call it a wrap here. Thank you for listening to Act and Unwind. If you're listening to this podcast on our website, please look in the show notes for a link to where you can subscribe directly to Act and Unwind, or just search Act and Unwind on your favorite podcast app. Also, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, 5-star reviews only, so that more people can find this program. Thanks to Emily. Thanks to Noah. For the Acton Institute, I'm Dan Huger. We'll see you next week.